As we contrasted last week, we saw how different Jonathan is from his father, Saul. So Saul, who is king over Israel, we know that his soldiers are very tenuously following him. Jonathan, back in chapter 13, has got up and has struck one of the Philistine garrisons. And we know, once again, Saul was inactive on that. Jonathan takes the initiative, gets up with his 1,000 men, strikes one of the Philistine garrisons. The Philistines get word of it. And so they bring all of their iron chariots and they bring the full forces of their army to stamp out this rebellion against the Israelites before it can ever gain any traction and gain any ground. And so all of the army, remember, has deserted with the exception of 600 men that are still following Saul. So Jonathan and his armor bearer are in a very precarious position. The Philistines are lined up. They're prepared to make war on Israel. And what we see here is this infiltration that Jonathan and his armor bearer, two men, make as they sneak over to one of the Philistine garrisons. And verse 6 is really that point of emphasis. If you haven't got this underlined in your Bible, mark that one down. Such a very great and powerful truth here, and such a demonstration of faith and courage that we see in Jonathan, where he said to his armor bearer, "Come and let us cross over the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." So we talked about his courage and his humility. We talked about his initiative, his faith, his trust in God. Jonathan also seemed to be a student of history, at least to some degree, and we'll talk more about what I mean by that. Jonathan was a student of history, Israel's history, in just a moment. And so Jonathan, faithful man of God, decides to let the Lord dictate his next course of action. He's obviously outnumbered, so he says to his armor bearers, he says, "Well, let's go over there and see what happens. Maybe the Lord will work through us to bring about a great victory for Israel." So he says, we're going to show ourselves to them, and if they say, "You come up here to us," if the Philistine garrison says, "You come up here to us," then we'll know that the Lord has given them into our hands. But if they say, "Wait there, we'll come to you," then he says, "Okay, we'll take that as a sign from the Lord to retreat." So they show themselves to the garrison, and sure enough, the Philistines say, "Hey, come over here, we want to tell you something." And so it's at that point that Jonathan knows that the Lord has given them into his hands. And so he and his armor bearer go up and kill about 20 of them. Okay, there's a lesson here for us. And the lesson is this: there is a time where faith waits, but there's also a time when faith acts. Okay, we have to determine, is this time to act or is this time to wait? We know the passage, and I think it's Psalm 46, "Be still and know that I am God." And so there are times in our life where the faithful thing that we do is we wait. We refrain from acting. We simply trust in the Lord. But there are also times when our faith must act, and we have to distinguish wisely between when those times are. You see, Saul was back home under the pomegranate tree waiting, wasn't he? When in reality, Saul should have been acting. He was king of Israel. He was the leader. The people were afraid. They needed someone to step up, show some faith, and they would have followed him. However, Saul doesn't do so. He's under the pomegranate tree. Jonathan takes the initiative. Jonathan acts in faith. And the Lord, as we're going to see in a moment, is going to bring a great victory by his hand. Tommy?
Yeah. What I got out of this is that we need to be prepared and we need to be in a position to take advantage of something when the Lord presents that opportunity.
That's good. Some people might have a tendency to just say, "I'm going to stand here and wait for the Lord to open the door," and they don't ready themselves, you know, for when the opportunity does come along. And so that's a good point to make. They were ready. Jonathan and his armor bearer, he was geared up. He was ready to go. He had prepared himself for this battle, and he simply waited for the Lord to open the door, didn't he? And that's what he did. And that's a good lesson for us, is that we don't just stand around and wait for the Lord to open the door. We ready ourselves for when that opportunity comes along, and then when God opens the door, we walk through it in faith. So from the human perspective, this was not a battle that anyone in their right mind would enter into. Two men versus a garrison, and I don't know what size army that would be, what size group of men, contingent that would be. However, we know that they were vastly outnumbered. There were at least 20 because they killed 20, and we know that there are probably more than that because they kind of scattered the garrison that was there. So this is not a decision that someone makes in their right mind. But Jonathan was zealous for God. As he said, he knew that God could save by many or by few. But I said Jonathan was also a student of history. He recalled Israel's history. You see, before Saul's reign, the Israelites were ruled by judges. And if you stop and think about some of those judges were oftentimes single men who acted on faith, as Jonathan's going to do, as a catalyst that would bring about Israel's deliverance. Because Israel frequently was under the judgment and punishment of God from various enemies, the Philistines, the Moabites, other nations, whenever they were disobedient and were idolatrous, God would send the enemies, their enemies, to come and to punish them and to oppress them. And so Jonathan remembers from what he was taught about God's faithfulness in working through a single man to deliver a nation. If you think back to Shamgar, how many people did Shamgar kill with an ox goat? Anybody remember? One man wipes out 600. 600 men with an ox goat. See why Jonathan's thinking, okay, the Lord can deliver by many or by few? Think of Gideon. We talked about him several times. There's a lot of correlation between Gideon and the stories here that we're reading, the narratives we're reading of the early kings. So Gideon and his army of 300 versus 135,000 Moabites, Midianites, excuse me. Once again, God delivers against many with just a few. Samson, a single man, takes the jawbone of a donkey and kills 1,000 Philistines. And so that's why I said Jonathan was a student of history. Not only was he a man of faith, but he was a student of history. He thinks back in the past of Israel, and he hears of how he was told of these great heroes of faith who stepped out, who acted, and by whom the Lord delivered them from a situation that was humanly impossible. And so he knew it was within God's power to deliver. He also knew that God may have been just waiting for someone to step out in faith, and Jonathan was willing to be that man. Now, from a human perspective, this should not have happened. They should not have won. And truth be told, his victory wasn't from the hand of men. We know that God miraculously empowered those people because one man can't kill 600 simply by his own strength. I don't care how strong he is. And Samson, we know, we're told that he was divinely empowered by the Spirit of God that would come on him. And that did come on him in that particular instance. You know, you think of 600 people, well, they could just swarm a single man and kill him if they wanted to do that. And so we know that God was involved in this. Let's read on in 1 Samuel 14 here, picking up in verse 15. Jonathan steps out in faith, attacks and kills the 20 with his armor bearer. And by the way, this was mentioned to me after class last week. Kudos to the armor bearer that was willing to go with Jonathan. That took a great deal of faith and that took a great deal of courage to go and to attack a garrison with just one other man. And obviously the armor bearer would have been to some degree a man of war. Not just some little boy who would have carried Jonathan's armor around. He would have been a fighter in and of his own self. And yet he says, you go and you do what's in your hand to do. What you think is best. And he says, I'll follow you. And so there's a great deal of courage on his behalf. So there were at least two brave, faithful men in Israel on this day. But let's pick up our reading in verse 15 and see what Jonathan stepping out in faith calls this to happen. Verse 15 of 1 Samuel 14, there was great trembling in the camp and among all the people. Even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked so that it was a great trembling. This is what God's doing in response to Jonathan's action. Verse 16, now Saul's watchmen in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away, the army melted away, and they went here and there. Saul said to the people who were with him, number now and see who has gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Then Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here. For the ark of God was at that time among the sons of Israel. So jump down to verse 20. Saul and all of the people who were with him rallied. They came to the battle, and behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was a great confusion. So the Lord, as he has frequently done in the past, sends confusion throughout the enemy army, and they begin fighting one another, killing one another. Verse 22, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard the Philistines had fled, even they also pursued them closely in the battle. So here it is, verse 23. So the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth Aven. So Jonathan is the catalyst who steps out in faith, kills 20 men. God is with him. God shows, I'm willing to help you work through this. So God delivers Jonathan. Then God sends the earthquake. Then God turns the enemy army upon itself so that they begin destroying one another. And it's only then that the men of Israel look around, see the Philistines melting away, and they have the courage to come out of their hiding places and to join the battle. And so verse 23 sums it up, so the Lord delivered Israel on that day. Actually, there is something that can restrain the hand of the Lord, and Saul was showing it. What is it that restrains God's hand, God's power to save? And I mean, in a sense, God can work around that if he chooses. But there is something, God working within man, that restrains God's power to save. What's that? Okay, well, sin. I'm thinking of a particular sin. Dave?
Well, I was just going to say his own will.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So unbelief, I mean, I think you could tie that in with both of you are saying. Think about unbelief. In fact, if you jump to Matthew 13:58, I'm not going to read that, but the statement is made, I believe it's while Jesus was at Capernaum. It said that he was not able to do many miracles there because of the people's unbelief. Now, you and I both understand that someone believing in Jesus was not necessary for him to perform a miracle. He was God in the flesh. He could perform that by the power of the Holy Spirit had he wished. However, unbelief restrains, in a sense, the hand of God. And that's what Saul was doing. He was hiding under the tree. God was there. His power was available. But Saul's unbelief and refusal to trust in God is what kept him at bay. And so the Lord doesn't work until someone comes along in faith. And that's what Jonathan does. And so unbelief can restrain God's hand. And we need to keep that in mind as we think about our life. And maybe we need to ask ourselves, is God's power being restrained within my life? Because I lack faith, just like Saul did. So we need great faith in life to serve God. And Jonathan demonstrated what Romans 8:31 says. If God is for us, who can be against us? And I tell you, that reality will change your life, brothers, sisters. If God is for us, who can be against us? And the answer is no one. No one. And Jonathan demonstrated that by his great faith as he stepped out and allowed the Lord to work through him. And we need to recognize that as we think about our life, as we think about opportunities that may come our way. Maybe the Lord opens a door and we're hesitant to go through because we think, well, this is beyond my capability. This is outside of my comfort zone. Well, faith in yourself and your own abilities. You recognize, like Jonathan, from a human perspective, this just doesn't seem like it can pan out. But maybe if we just put our trust in God and we stepped out in faith, then in our weakness, God's power would be demonstrated. And like Jonathan, God would take control of the situation. He would pour out His grace to provide what was needed, whatever we felt was lacking on our part, and He would compensate for what we did not have. And so we need to approach life in such a way and not simply look at it through the perspective of human power and human capability. And we may run and hide because it appears that we're outnumbered, because like Saul, we're looking through human eyes. But what we need to remember is what Jonathan said, that God can deliver by many or by few. And He may just be waiting for someone to step out in faith, and then He rewards that faith. And we could tell countless stories of how that has happened throughout the Bible. Now I wonder, too, if Jonathan's faith in this situation might have served as something for an example for another young man of faith who was going to come along shortly. What I'm talking about and what I'm referencing is David and his battle with Goliath. And I'm not putting this forth by any means as necessarily being the case, but I can't help but wonder if Jonathan's faith in this instance and the word that would have spread throughout the people of Israel might have just spurred David on a little bit. If you think about these similarities between these two statements as Jonathan finds himself facing a Philistine garrison and David against Goliath, just kind of look at these side by side and consider it for yourself. Jonathan says, "Come, let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." And then as David faces off against Goliath, this seemingly impossible, from a human perspective, battle, David says, "The Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hands." So whether this was a means of inspiration for David or completely unrelated at all, we don't know if it was coincidence or perhaps word of Jonathan's faith spread through Israel. We can't know. However, this is complementary of both men, as it shows us that they were both cut from a very similar cloth. That is, a courage and a faith and an initiative to be willing to step out and allow God to work through them. So Jonathan's actions and his armor bearer's actions have turned the favor of the army. And it's at this point that Saul gives a very foolish order. He said, "Cursed is anyone, as the rout is now on. God has sent the earthquake. The Philistines have turned on each other. They're now dispersing. They're fleeing in terror, knowing God is fighting for Israel." Saul makes a very foolish vow. He says, "Cursed is the one who eats anything before evening until I am avenged of my enemies." So once again, you notice there's Saul's pride kind of coming out a little bit. We've seen that early on where he took claim. He took the honor from Jonathan's victory, Jonathan's courage. So he says, "Now cursed is anyone who eats anything until I am avenged from my enemies." So he probably gave this command for a couple reasons. One, he wanted to make sure that the rout was completed, that the people didn't stop to eat, and that they would immediately just go ahead and finish the job, drive home the killing blow. And it's also possible he may have been proclaiming a fast until they were victorious. Either way, very foolish command, as we're going to see. And interestingly, Jonathan was not around whenever this vow was made by Saul. David?
Context is how this works well. Now it says sometimes, I take it, sometimes you see people in the mouth, it works well. They say, come up here and want to show you something. They got to show
it. That they did. So, well, if you're on the side of the Lord, then feel free to open your mouth and put your faith, let your faith step into, speak for you. I think that's what Jonathan did. But you're right. Even then, as I said, there's a time to wait, keep your mouth shut maybe, and there's a time to act. Open your mouth, put your trust in the Lord, and let that spur you on to action. But yeah, the Philistines made the mistake opening their mouth, inviting them over, and in doing so, they sealed their own doom, didn't they? All right, so Saul makes this rash oath. Nobody's eating until the victory is complete, until I am avenged. Okay. So question three, Jonathan's weary eyes brightened when he ate a little bit of what? I don't remember, Jim or David, did we leave off with one of you last week? Okay. Brother Barker, do you know the answer to this question? All right. Jonathan's weary eyes brightened when he ate a little bit of honey. And that's in 1 Samuel 14 and verse 27. So, Saul's army is exhausted. You can imagine, after a day of waging war and after a day of fighting their enemies, that they're on the verge of collapse. And Saul has brilliantly issued this curse upon anyone who eats anything before the Philistines are completely defeated. So Jonathan wasn't present. One commentator that I read thought that perhaps that this honey that they stumbled upon, and it wasn't just a single hive. Let's just go back and look there. Verse 26, 1 Samuel 14, when the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey. Okay, and so we're talking about something that could have provided refreshment and energy for the army. And one of the commentators that I read suggested it was very possible that God had even sent this as a providential gift to provide for the Israelites so that they could finish the work that they were set out to do. As we're going to see, Jonathan, who was weary, he revived whenever he took just a little bite of the honey when he reached out his rod and he ate some of it. So mop-up duty was an important part of war in the ancient times. And it prevented the enemy from regrouping and launching a counterattack. And really, while you got your enemy down, you want to just go ahead and put him out of commission so that you end the threat completely. And so the people were in need of food, and Jonathan scoops up some honey and he eats it, and almost immediately his countenance brightens. So they continue on, and Israel's rout of the Philistines is incomplete because Saul had issued the vow. The people were exhausted, and they weren't able to put them away the way that they would have otherwise been able to. So later that day, Saul is seeking counsel from the Lord, and he gets no answer. Now, I'm going to say that was probably already found because Samuel to realize as that I made. And so they'd cast lots who was guilty, and the Lord would reveal that to them through the lot that was being cast. And he vows to put the perpetrator to death. They cast lots, and the lot falls on Jonathan. At this point, Saul is ready to have Jonathan put to death. Look at verse 44. 1 Samuel 14 says, do this to me, and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. So we see once again a contrast and Saul, after it's revealed that Jonathan has broken the vow. Saul could have admitted he was wrong. He could have humbled himself and retracted that, or sought some other means of paying it back and fulfilling the vow, fulfilling the breach that was done. But Saul's a proud man. Remember that? And that's really the curse that's going to bring him down. Saul's a proud man. And so there in front of his army, rather than relinquishing, repenting, and saying, okay, I shouldn't have said what I said, he says, Jonathan's going to die on my life. And look at verse 43. Look at Jonathan. Jonathan says, Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you've done. Jonathan said, I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, and I must die. So Jonathan is willing to lay down his life for his father's foolish oath, and Saul is ready to take it because of his foolish pride. One commentator rightly makes this observation of Saul's rashness. Listen to this. They write, strange perverseness. He who is so indulgent as to spare wicked Agag, chapter 15, is now so severe as to destroy his own worthy son. Okay, think forward in chapter 15. where Saul is sent to the Amalekites to crush them completely. At the word of the Lord, Saul brings back the king. So he spares the king of his enemies, but here he is ready to kill his own son to defend his foolish pride. So you see, Jonathan knew his father. If his father wouldn't have acted foolishly, if he wouldn't have made the vow, they'd have taken the food, they would have routed the Philistines the way that they should have. And Jonathan was the catalyst that brought about the victory. He was the voice of reason that should have been an end to the war. And it's clear the people love and trust him. Because while Saul is ready to have him killed, the people step up and they reject Saul's action. So we have here kind of a pause in between the stories as Jonathan's going to fade out, but we do need to lay some groundwork for Jonathan coming into the story next. Dad?
Before we get on to the point about people intervening, we don't need to get the idea that they told Paul, so we took a popular vote and we decided to spare Jonathan. The more likely it was, you're not going to kill him. If anybody dies here, it's going to be you. We're willing to defend Jonathan to the death if necessary. And it's very likely they told Saul, you're not going to do it. And there will be consequences if you try.
It's possible. And we also know that Saul's demonstrated that he has a tendency toward cowardice. Verse 45 kind of sums that up, like Dad was saying. But the people said to Saul, must Jonathan die who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it, as the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people can clearly see what Saul is too blind and too arrogant to see. And like you're saying, there seems to be a little taste of a threat in the statement. They say, as the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground this day. And I think the insinuation is, go ahead and try it. But nothing's going to happen to Jonathan, and we're going to see to that. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. So.
And, you know, there may have been a little conflict between Saul and Jonathan. Back when he first tasted the honey, and somebody told him that your father swore an oath, Jonathan says, my father's brought trouble upon this land. He recognizes the foolish attempt on the sacrifice, and then this deal's not letting them eat, knowing that they need their strength going into battle.
Right.
And Jonathan recognizes that his father is a weak man prone to poor decision making.
And that's only going to grow, the disparity between Jonathan and Saul. And we're gonna see them being pushed further and further apart as the story progresses.
You may even consider the fact that Jonathan is a commander in the army. He's going to advise his father on situations, or attempt to, I'm sure. And there may be some conflict there because he doesn't have as high of an opinion of Saul as Saul does of himself.
Well, I don't think anybody had as high of an opinion of Saul as Saul had of himself. But you're right, there may very well have been some bad blood. But at the same time, we do see Saul wanting to see Jonathan take the throne. We're going to see that kind of rising up in the upcoming chapters. So a quick interlude before we move on. Saul is rejected and David is anointed. This kind of happens in between where we're leaving off with the victory that Jonathan brought about by the hand of the Lord and the next time he steps onto the scene. So David in between comes onto the scene. He is anointed by Samuel. Remember, God told Saul, because you've disobeyed me, I'm going to seek out a man after my own heart. I'm going to make him king. So David's anointed by Samuel as the king, the man after God's own heart. So God's Spirit leaves Saul. The Holy Spirit leaves Saul, and he goes upon David. And an evil spirit, we're told, was sent to terrorize Saul in his place. So Saul calls for a musician, and the music soothes the evil spirit. And David is the musician that is called to soothe Saul. 1 Samuel 16:21, then David came to Saul and attended to him, and Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. So once again, pointing back to the armor bearer that helped Jonathan, the armor bearer was not some small, weak, little 12-year-old boy that was carrying around a grown man's armor. David becomes an armor bearer of Saul, and this is after he has killed Goliath. So at first, Saul was very fond of David, loved him greatly. Right before Goliath. Chapter 17, David comes onto the scene. David defeats Goliath. And in 1 Samuel 18:1, it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul. This is important because this is going to underline the relationship between Jonathan and David from this point forward. It came about when he had finished speaking, this is right after Goliath had been killed, and David speaking with Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own self. So that's underlying the relationship and the friendship that we're going to see develop between these two men. Question 4. Jonathan made a blank with David because he loved him as his own self. Made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own self. That's in 1 Samuel 18. We're moving on. 1 Samuel 18, verse 3. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own. So there's a lot of things that happened here that we aren't told about. Chapter 17 ends with the defeat of Goliath and this conversation between Saul and David. After the victory, David is brought to Saul's house where he's going to serve as a military leader for the king. Remember, Samuel said, whenever you anoint a king, you ask for a king, he's going to take your sons, he's going to enlist them into his army. He's going to make them fight for him. And so that's exactly what happens here. David is pressed into military service for Saul. And at this point in time, David's already been anointed. However, Saul is on the throne. And although he is acting as king, Saul has been removed by God. And this was for stepping into the priest role, remember. On that day when Samuel told Saul that he had been rejected as God's king, it's unlikely that Saul told anyone. Jonathan was off, remember, with his army, and so he doesn't necessarily know that Samuel has denounced Saul as king, and therefore his position is in jeopardy as well. Somehow it seems, though, and this, like I said, there's a lot here we're not told. Somehow it seems that Jonathan is made aware that David is chosen to be the next king of Israel. And because of his great love for David, he makes this covenant with him. And the reason we know that is because the covenant involves the throne and because Jonathan's actions in verse 4 that we're going to see. Look down and we'll probably just have to end with this. 1 Samuel 18:4, this is the covenant. Jonathan stripped himself of his robe that was on him and he gave it to David with his armor, including his sword, with his bow and his belt. So Jonathan takes off his princely garb and he gives it to David to wear. Now, this seems pretty indicative that Jonathan understands what he is giving to David. And perhaps this single action tells us more about Jonathan than anything else. Because you would expect a son of Saul to be petty and arrogant and power hungry. However, Jonathan, as I said, he's everything that Saul is not. Jonathan's anything but that. He is humble, he is loyal, and he is faithful to David. And what the crown prince is doing is he is swearing fealty to his successor. Let me share this quote with you from the Enduring Word commentary where Jonathan gives David his armor, and we'll close with that and pick up with another interlude next week. So this guy says, David couldn't receive Saul's armor. Remember, whenever he gets ready to go fight Goliath, armor's too heavy. David couldn't receive Saul's armor, David received Jonathan's armor, not only because they were more similar in size, more importantly, they shared the same soul. They both loved God and lived more for him and for others more than themselves. David and Jonathan both knew that if the circumstances were reversed, David would do the exact same thing for Jonathan because they had the same soul. And I really like that tie-in there, how David receives Jonathan's armor because they're cut from the same cloth. They're the same type of man who is loyal and faithful and obedient to God. Meanwhile, Saul's armor was not able to be put on by David whenever he tried to take it in battle. So this is essentially a handing off and a recognition on behalf of Jonathan. He's swearing fealty. The crown prince is swearing fealty to this new man that God has anointed as king. How it was revealed to him that he would be king, we can't know, but this seems to be what's taking place there. 1 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 4. So next week we'll pick up with a second interlude, move through that really quickly, and then move on with our study of Jonathan. So such a great man here. I hope you're growing to appreciate him and learn a little bit about him along the way. So we'll pick up next week in 1 Samuel chapter 18 as we discover more about the friendship that Jonathan and David shared.